Take a network break. I'm Drew Conry Murray.
I'm John Burke.
Help yourself to a virtual donut and join us for our weekly rundown of IT news. Today, we're going to talk about a Zoom outage and hint, it was DNS, a new NAT gateway offering from Aviatrix, an IPv6 milestone in the Asia-Pac region, clientless ZTA, some financial results, and more. This episode is brought to you today by Catchpoint. Catchpoint's an internet performance monitoring platform. It gives you visibility into everything in the internet stack that impacts your user's experience so you can anticipate, detect, and fix problems fast. Learn more at the break or see for yourself at catchpoint.com/packetpushers. By the way, if you like Network Break, Packet Pushers has a bunch of other podcasts, including Day 2 DevOps, Heavy Networking, IPv6 Buzz, Network Automation Nerds, Packet Protector, and Heavy Strategy, plus more, and more are coming. It's nerdy tech analysis and compelling conversations about infrastructure, cloud, professional development, and even more. It's all at packetpushers.net. John, you want to kick us off with our weekly Red Alert?
So this week's red alert is that NetWeaver Visual Composer Metadata Uploader allows unauthenticated uploads. There were 871 CVEs created this week, ending April 24th, and another 3,380 were updated. Wow. 15 of the total scored a 10 out of 10, and 368 ranked as critical, scoring 9.5 or better. The red alert winner this week is CVE 2025-31324, which details how SAP's NetWeaver's Visual Composer Metadata Uploader, so a component of a package that people use for their net stuff, is not protected for uploads. So an unauthenticated actor can upload arbitrary files, including malicious executables, that can severely harm a host system. A file uploaded to the unprotected space would be executed automatically. No user interactions are required. So the hosting system at least is vulnerable to compromise or denial of service by uploading software that would brick it and could serve as a stepping stone for lateral attacks. SAP has not yet patched the vulnerability as far as we can see, so network security folks will have to block access to the system to mitigate this.
Something fun for to start your week. Links in the show notes if you want to get details. We'll switch into news. First, Forward Networks, they make network digital twins. They've added endpoint discovery and collection to their capabilities. And just a little background, if you're not familiar with Forward, they build a digital twin by collecting configuration and state data from network devices, so routers, switches, load balancers, SD-WAN gateways, et cetera. And then once this digital twin is built, network engineers can use it to understand how traffic is flowing through the network and also check to see if actual traffic flows align with your policy. Do you have things segmented the way you want it to? It also provides an inventory of your network devices that is updated regularly, so way better than the spreadsheet you're probably using. Forward also offers something called the Network Query Engine that basically lets you query that data model of the digital twin so you can use natural language to ask your network things about like device configurations and so on. So they're now adding endpoint discovery capabilities. They can collect the IP and MAC addresses of devices connected to the network, so things like laptops, PCs, printers, and IoT devices. I got a briefing from Forward, and right now this is a pretty bare bones feature. If you're thinking like an Nmap scan that's going to tell you everything on there and maybe do some fingerprinting, that is not this. It's essentially going to tell you the IP address and the MAC of the devices on it. It's also a little bit manual in how you're doing this discovery to get those endpoints discovered and into the data model. It's also not included in the digital twin. So it's essentially to me like a more detailed inventory system of what's on your network. And this is also, I think, Forward's first foray into this. They said it was a customer feature request. They're planning to expand its capabilities over time. So right now, it's basically just going to tell you, here's the IP addresses and MACs of some devices on your network.
I am always a fan of anything that will help people manage the endpoints on their networks, find the endpoints on their networks, and keep track of the information about them. I am surprised this is still a problem that needs solving. But I expect I'm going to continue to be surprised for another few years at least.
What's on the network is always fertile ground for innovation and new work. So yeah.
But I mean, the last big programming thing I tried to do myself back in 2005 was to write a system to do that. And even then there were commercial solutions available. So we'll keep solving that one.
Yeah, I think so.
Speaking of problems that we keep solving. Remote access. Ericsson has a SASE solution that they have added a clientless ZTNA module to in order to support especially third-party access. Ericsson has added Zero Trust Network Access to its NetCloud SASE, building on its client-based solution. So this clientless Zero Trust Network Access is there to especially support third-party support of IoT systems that a lot of Ericsson customers deploy. In addition to clientless operation, application sessions that are spun up via the ZTNA are run in isolated cloud containers, especially when they're associated with unmanaged or BYOD devices, adding an extra layer of insulation for the corporate systems that the unsecured devices are reaching out to. Other features include least privilege enforcement of access control policies that can key off all the usual things like device types, users' roles, the source location from which they're coming, and other factors. Real-time access revocation in response to changes in user context or risk levels. So if somebody suddenly goes from their home Wi-Fi to, you know, Wi-Fi in a coffee shop, it will in real time be able to shift them to a different control policy. It also provides for stealthing and other kinds of zero trust defaults so that there is no static public IP address. All internal IPs are hidden, all access defaults to deny all, and the system supports micro-segmentation to further prevent lateral movement from a compromised container. So all of that's from Ericsson.
So you mentioned IoT devices in the press release I read. They're also looking at BYOD use cases. So if you've got, you know, contractors or partners coming onto the network wanting to get access to applications with a smartphone or a laptop, they can also, I guess, provide what sounds like the session runs inside a container that sort of springs up for the life of the session and then is destroyed when that session ends?
Exactly so. Separate from anybody else's container, separate from any past containers or future containers for the same person, completely isolated and transitory access module, basically.
Okay. The other news here for me is that Ericsson had a SASE solution.
That. That was a little bit of a surprise for me, too. So, yeah.
Two birds with one stone. Moving on, Aviatrix, they provide cloud networking and security for connecting on-prem and public cloud services. They've announced the Aviatrix SecureNAT Gateway for Microsoft Azure. The SecureNAT Gateway, which is available in the Azure Marketplace, inspects egress traffic to help prevent exfiltration and can monitor egress costs. I think part of the news here is that Aviatrix is positioning SecureNAT Gateway as a way for Azure users to deal with an upcoming change to how Azure is going to handle outbound access for virtual machines. Right now, Azure assigns a default public IP address if you create a VM without specifying how it connects to the internet. Starting in September 2025, Azure's not going to provide default outbound internet access for newly created VMs. So Aviatrix says its SecureNAT Gateway can help you manage default internet access policies, scale that egress traffic capacity, and provide traffic inspection. John, I hear you laughing.
Just happy to see that a bad default behavior is being eliminated. That is an excellent change. Bravo, Microsoft.
Yes, it is a good thing. But if you are also not prepared for that and suddenly you're wondering why this VM can't reach the internet, Aviatrix would like to have a word.
Speaking of being unprepared and not being sure why you can't reach things on the internet, our next story is GoDaddy error, knocking out Zoom for 2 hours, or almost 2.5, really. On April 16th, around 11:25 a.m. Pacific time in the U.S., Zoom users began reporting an inability to connect to Zoom conferences and other services, such as Zoom's VoIP telephony. ThousandEyes diagnosed a DNS issue with the Zoom U.S. domain, one which was rapidly turning into a problem for Zoom.com as well, because content distribution networks that look to the Zoom.us domain for content were no longer able to get to it, so they couldn't refresh the .com resources that they were caching in their various POPs. On investigation, Zoom reported later that day, they found that their own name servers were replying correctly to requests. However, digging into the issue with their domain name registrars, Mark Monitor and GoDaddy Registry, they discovered that the domain zoom.us was in fact unavailable due to a server block placed on it by GoDaddy Registry.
Oh, wow.
That block, I know, right? That block resulted from a communications error between Mark Monitor, Zoom's domain registrar, and the GoDaddy registry, which led to the latter mistakenly shutting down the zoom.us domain. After they figured this all out, service was restored about 2.5 hours after the problem surfaced at 1:55 p.m. Pacific time.
Wow, that's quite a DNS outage. And sort of reading this and outside of the context of these, I'm sure a lot of these operations are automated, but it seems like a domain like zoom.us should probably not ever be blocked. I don't know.
It was quite a shock, and it is just another testament to the complexity of the behind-the-scenes machinations that bring us access to things with something as simple as a domain name, and the ongoing perils of automation, because none of that happened because somebody decided to make it happen and pushed a button. That was all automation.
All right, links in the show notes if you want to read up on it. Just a quick break to tell you about our sponsor today, Catchpoint. Catchpoint's an internet performance monitoring platform. It gives you visibility into everything in the internet stack that impacts your user experience so you can anticipate, detect, and fix problems fast. Catchpoint helps you proactively identify and resolve issues across the internet stack before they impact customers, the workforce, or digital experiences. Catchpoint's internet performance monitoring platform analyzes telemetry from the world's largest, most diverse observability network, including thousands of locations in hundreds of countries, with cloud nodes at the app source, on backbone and broadband nodes, and the last mile where user experiences occur. With Catchpoint, you can find root causes faster, improve mean time to resolution, and cut down on the finger pointing, because it's not always the network. You can find out more at catchpoint.com/packetpushers. That's catchpoint.com/packetpushers. And John, we're back to the news with the IPv6 milestone for the Asia Pacific region.
Indeed, a really happy occasion. The Asia Pacific Network Information Center, or APNIC, reported on April 23rd that in the region for which they manage addressing, which encompasses 56 nations and stretches all the way from Afghanistan to Fiji in the South Pacific, 50% or more of the devices for which they check services were able to reply to their IPv6 requests. That is, they are IPv6 capable. Huh. Many, of course, are dual stack, but they are actively delivering services via IPv6 and so are considered IPv6 capable. APNIC's economies cover about 64% of IPv6 users worldwide, and they generate more than half of the IPv6 traffic. India has the highest level of adoption at 78%. Capable, with Vietnam next highest at 60%, while the growth of IoT and 5G and soon 6G are expected to really deepen the reach and breadth of IPv6 adoption, APNIC noted that globally, only about 34% of systems are IPv6 capable, and the shift off IPv4 is happening at a low and linear rate.
Yeah, IPv4 persistence continues. Well, I guess it shouldn't amaze me, but it is there. And I note that this 50% does seem like it has a little caveat to it, given that, as you said, many of these are dual stack devices, which probably means they are primarily using V4, even though they can receive V6 packets.
Indeed. And that same job where I was writing the network mapping software for myself, when I interviewed for that job, so that was like, 1997, I was asked if the university should accelerate its efforts to adopt IPv6.
Yeah, the problems remain. They are different day, same problems. Yeah. So moving on, we're in the tariff era here in the United States, and one justification of those tariffs, particularly on China, is to spur more homegrown manufacturing in the U.S. A headline caught my eye that tariffs are shifting manufacturing away from China, but it seems to be heading in some ways towards India. For instance, Apple is holding talks with Foxconn and Tata to increase its iPhone manufacturing footprint in India, with the goal of having the majority of phones targeted for the U.S. market to be made in India, because if they are shipped from India, they will avoid those tariffs if they were coming from China. At present, 80% of iPhones sold in the U.S. are made in China, according to Reuters. By moving manufacturing to India, Apple hopes to avoid the tariffs that may or may not be levied against China. Foxconn and Tata currently have 3 factories in India that can manufacture iPhones, and Reuters reports that Foxconn and Tata are building 2 more. John, from a strategic perspective, is it smart for Apple to move now, or to just try to like hold off and see what happens, given the tariffs are there, they're not, they're up, they're down?
I think it's a smart move for Apple to diversify the number of places where it can manufacture iPhones and be able to shift production among those locations, tariffs or not, because such a dramatic overdependence on China is probably not in its long-term strategic best interests.
Okay, so even if somewhere down the line the U.S. decides India is the problem and decides to levy higher tariffs against it, you still think this is a good idea?
Yeah, I don't think they should stop with India, and I definitely think they should try and manufacture a substantial fraction of their phones for the U.S. in the U.S. But, you know, for the next several years, there's no telling where tariffs will be applied or how steep they will be or how long they will last or anything else. So spreading it out as much as possible seems like a good move.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think I'm with you on that. I think also the fact that it sounds like it's Tata and Foxconn who are building these factories, there is less of a risk for Apple. I don't know if Apple has any financial investment in the construction of these facilities, but it sounds like most of the risk is probably on Foxconn and Tata.
Probably, and I'm sure they're thinking that if the deal falls through with Apple, partway through even, they'll be able to use the manufacturing capacity for something else.
Yeah, probably.
So moving on, we have the Fortinet achieving GovRAMP moderate authorization for its AI-powered security services and FortiCare. FortiGuard's AI-powered security services and FortiCare services have achieved authorization for moderate impact use cases from the Government Risk and Authorization Management Program, or GovRAMP. Now, that's not the same thing as FedRAMP, which inspired it. It is, in fact, aimed at state and local governments instead of the federal government. So FortiGuard AI-powered security services are integrated into Fortinet's security fabric, and they provide threat intelligence services to it. And the FortiCare services, of course, help with deployment and operations. So GovRAMP requires that manufacturers or service providers meet standards that are based on what the U.S.'s National Institute of Standards and Technology laid out in their special publication 800-53, Rev 4, which was in turn modeled in part on the FedRAMP requirements. So Fortinet had to meet all the security requirements laid out in that framework and had to have a successful audit by an authorized third-party assessing organization, a 3PAO.
Working with the government seems like it can be so difficult. So I assume this is probably a significant effort on Fortinet's part to achieve this authorization.
It is, and it's again for state and local governments, which is even harder in some ways than the federal government because the requirements vary from state to state to state in the United States. So there's that. What's interesting to me is that it's only moderate level.
I noticed that, yes.
It's not for the higher levels, and I'm interested in what the higher level requirements are that they either haven't tried to meet yet or haven't met yet.
Yeah, we know that Fortinet has been having some issues with security vulnerabilities in their products. I don't know if that's related to getting like GovRAMP and FedRAMP authorization, although I assume it certainly doesn't help.
I sure hope it doesn't help, let's put it that way.
Right. It seems like it should be a problem.
Yeah.
All right. We'll wrap up with a couple of financial results. We'll start with Intel. Intel reported financial results for its first quarter of 2025. Revenues were $12.7 billion flat year over year, and the company lost $800 million for the quarter. The new CEO, Lip Bu-tan, says layoffs are coming in Q2, though no target number has been officially announced. The CEO also noted that he wants Intel to be more engineering-driven and less bureaucratic. For instance, he says many teams are 8 layers deep and that team size has been a key performance indicator for managers. That is not the case anymore. He wants to eliminate managerial layers and he wants teams to do more with fewer people. This is all coming from a letter he wrote to the company and to investors. He also wants fewer meetings and for the number of meeting attendees to get smaller. And I'm all behind that. That's a plan everyone can get behind. He also plans to eliminate, quote, non-essential training and documentation and simplify performance reviews. As of September 1st, employees are also going to be expected to be in the office 4 days per week. Whether that does much for productivity, we'll see. But I think, particularly for a new CEO coming in and seeing, you know, bureaucracy that has accreciated over the years, this kind of debt clearing can be a good thing. I don't know if it's going to move the numbers significantly for Intel. I don't think the managerial system is really responsible for what's going on, but it could have some effect. John, what do you think?
I sure hope it at least improves their profitability. again, it's not the source of their problem, but I'm sure it doesn't help to have, you know, as many as 8 layers of bureaucracy in between engineers and leadership. at the top, and that the missed boats that are at the real root of Intel's problems, you know, they missed the mobility thing and they missed the AI thing to a large degree, won't be fixed by those layers of bureaucracy and might be fixed by the engineering teams. So we'll see.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I do think it's good for, Intel to try to recapture its being an engineer-led company. Besides layoffs, the company plans to cut operating expenses by $1.5 billion. That includes R&D, marketing, and general and administrative costs. In anticipation of those expected layoffs coming in Q2, just sort of virtual hugs for everyone affected. But it seems like the writing's on the wall for that. Last but not least, Google's parent company Alphabet also announced Q1 results. The company had revenues of $90.2 billion, up 12% year over year, with net income of $34.5 billion, which is also up. By business unit, Google's ad biz accounted for almost 75% of its revenue for the quarter at $66.89 billion, and ad revenues were up 8.5%. On its own, Google Cloud, the cloud business, their revenues were also up 28% at $12.3 billion. However, that growth was down from the last quarter, so Wall Street wasn't psyched about that. They're looking at potential cloud slowdowns, but still $12.3 billion for Google Cloud, pretty good.
Absolutely. And so far, no announcements of them holding off on leasing new data center space or cutting back on already in-process data center expansions. So yeah, maybe they won't be riding that particular train along with AWS and Microsoft.
Yeah, we'll see. I mean, it sounds like they're committing to AI, which probably means maintaining their commitments to infrastructure growth. CEO Sundar Pichai says that things like the AI Overviews feature, that's where Google provides you an AI-generated answer to search queries at the top of Google search page, now has 1.5 billion users every month. The CEO says Google's going to lean heavily into AI Overview going forward. Myself, I'm not really a fan of that feature, and the people I talk to don't really seem to like it, but you know, there's probably selection bias there. I don't know.
If you don't have to opt into it in the first place, if it just happens whether you want it to or not, do you really count as a user?
That's a good point. I wonder how that maybe people click through to see more, and that's how they're counting that 1.5 billion users every month. But it seems like that still has some problems that need to be worked out. And just another note, Google is facing some significant regulatory scrutiny here in the U.S., both in its ad and search businesses. They've both been deemed monopolies by U.S. judges. Possible remedies have been proposed, include spinning off its ad business and spinning off Google's ownership of Chrome. Both of those legal fights are ongoing, but they did not hurt Google's results this quarter. So things are going great.
And they've got scrutiny for antitrust or bad policy anyway in the EU as well, as I recall. So,
okay.
Yeah.
So keeping the lawyers busy at Alphabet.
It's good to have full employment for lawyers. They don't get into trouble that way.
That's true. I guess so. That does wrap up the news portion of the show. John, where can folks get more from you?
On LinkedIn. And I am very unmemorably John-Burke-29084B3, because oh, wow. John Burkes are thick on the ground in this world. But if you just search John Burke Nemertes on LinkedIn, you'll get to me right away.
That's right. And it's Burke, B-U-R-K-E, yes?
Yep. And John with an H.
We can also hear you on the Heavy Strategy podcast with Jonna Johnson.
That is totally correct.
Yeah, check it out. I'm Drew Conry Murray. I'm on Blue Sky at DrewCM, and I'm blogging at packetpushers.net. Thank you to our sponsor, Catchpoint. And as always, thank you for listening. If you've got feedback, comments, corrections, queries, you can hit us up at packetpushers.net/FU. The FU's for follow-up, and we do love to hear from you. And don't forget, over on packetpushers.net, we've got merch. We've got a dozen podcasts you can subscribe to, an industry blog, two weekly newsletters, a community Slack group, a YouTube channel, an IRC group, and more. Again, you can find it all at packetpushers.net. All free, no login required. As always, thanks for listening.